Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Good morning, Noah. Good morning, Teresa. I'm delighted to have you both on the Fundraising Talent Podcast with me this morning. Noah, you're our guest. Teresa, you're a member of the consulting team here at Responsive Fundraising. Let's before we dive into our topic of conversation, which I'm very much looking forward to, Noah, let's get you to introduce yourself, let our listeners know who you are, and then Teresa, how about you do the same?
Sure. Great. Thanks for the space and opportunity and privilege, Jason. My name is Noah Girding. I am currently the Director of Advancement for an organization locally here in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota, called the Sane Foundation. I joined just 6 weeks ago as this new position, so everything is fresh in my head.
Good deal. Who are you, Teresa?
I'm Teresa Lee, and I am a senior consultant with Responsive Fundraising. I joined up with Jason a little over a year ago. 3 years ago, I started my own consulting company. And prior to that, I had a higher ed career over 25 years in Greater Boston, 15 of the 25 at MIT, consider that my real home, and several other notable universities in the area. And now I help small nonprofits and universities with strategy and fundraising.
Noah, you're our first guest from Minneapolis in probably quite some time. And before we dive into our subject, I've got to give you an opportunity to sort of tell us what the landscape and the fundraising work looks like in the last 12 months. Minneapolis has been, obviously, for obvious reasons, in some cases, some tragic reasons, has been in the headlines. And so in the midst of COVID-19 and when you're raising money, what's it been like to raise money in Minneapolis for the last year?
Iterative, to be totally honest with you. Everything has been pretty much a moving target. I'll back up just as you can imagine, just for a second. Like my whole nonprofit career has actually been in the Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota area, and specifically in philanthropy, starting early as major gift officers and moving up to more of the administrative strategic side. So, you know, I would say everything from, I've had experience everything from animal welfare to disabilities to human and social services to housing instability. And really, the more people I talk to, the more it is so similar across industry within our sector in terms of what fundraisers are going through. We are experiencing the same pushes and pulls and successes and pains. And, you know, being new to this organization just six weeks-ish ago, underrepresented youth in our local areas still continue to experience, even before the murder of George Floyd, some of the most profound educational, economic, and employment disparities, and so often at the intersection of broken systems, as you probably know, designed to sadly perpetuate and produce the outcomes that they're generating. So my organization, the Sané Foundation, since our founding in 2003 and throughout all of the unrest with school districts moving to distance learning, a pandemic, other civil unrest, our partners are fundamentally closing opportunity and achievement gaps. And the opportunity and achievement gap is another theme that all of us as fundraisers in this community really are working to disrupt or to solve and to address. And our organization links those to the social determinants of health. So right now, at the highest level, our organization is working with families and youth so that they can access distance learning hubs that support their academic enrichment, fresh produce and nutritional services to combat food insecurity, and youth leadership through ongoing sports camps. So I think as a sentiment, it has been, it's been like the Minnesota, this has been interesting, like a true interesting time to raise funds. But there's so much that organizations and individuals are doing to close gaps. And really, as you all know, it's our work is rooted in genuine, authentic, non-transactional, relational relationships. And so if that is your true north, the success can look different.
Noah, what is a guy like me who basically gets all my news from MSNBC and CNN? You know, I'm the average white privileged guy in, you know, just north of Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. What is a guy like me not getting that a guy like you sort of picks up when the George Floyd story is sort of being told, the last 12 months or so?
Yeah. I think it's really, I mean, yeah, as you say, CNBC and whatever your medium or news choice is.
Yeah.
What is not being told are what it means to be underrepresented and what it actually means to do the work that we do, and how, I think one of your guests a few weeks ago, you had talked about the intersectionality of our work, and right, how everything truly is connected. And so that's not the A plus B equals C story, but that from a 90-10 principle, that's 90% of the work that all of us are trying to do. So that's the other side to what you're not seeing. Yeah. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. And, yeah, and I genuinely appreciate that. And I like to, one of the things I think that's so beneficial in our society now that I think people are all starting to come to grips with, even with current events with the stock market, for example, the fiasco that's playing out that way, is the connectivity that's happening in the way that people are able to communicate. You know, three of us can get on here and we can relate to a guy like you who's on the, you know, on the front lines, much closer to the quote unquote story. And some of those storytellers on the, you know, cable news networks that tell the story in very linear ways, are trying to keep up. And I genuinely appreciate that. Noah, you had an idea in mind. We always ask our guests to come on with a big idea or bold opinion. Yours is a very fresh and sort of not in line with what we've heard from a lot of our recent guests. So why don't you tee that up, and Teresa will, between Teresa and I, will keep you going for a while.
Sure. Yeah. And if I can back up also to last year a little bit too, and I want to take more of a, like my work is amazing and fulfilling and, you know, centering youth voice and all that I do and all that we do as an organization is thrilling. But, you know, 2020, introspectively taught me a lot. And so I want to back up and share a little bit about kind of what I went through personally in my profession and professionally, really. And I'm going to pose the question of, you know, that it's just that old adage, that old question of, you know, that feeling that you just get when something isn't right. You might not be able to at the time you're going through it, if it's a situation of trauma or uncertainty, you might not be able to put any words to it. For feeling of this is just not right. This just does not work for me. But yet I can't really explain it. Now, imagine that you had that feeling at the end of your second week into a new job.
Whoa.
And I felt that last January, and I've never felt that before. As you know, as you've looked at my, you know, my history, I don't jump around a lot, because you can't make needles move, right? You can't make needles move. You can't bring donors along. You can't bring your supporters along in a timeline that really is probably less than 4 or 5 years. And so,
yeah,
you know, of a true moves management, robust, right, relationship
totally.
System. So I've really, you know, taken that, that lens to my work of like, what can be like that abundance mindset and bringing an inquisitive lens to discover the art of the possible, really. And, you know, we have to, as we talked about, because our work is so intersectional, and what we do when we're grounded in authentic relationships is helping bridge supporter interests with community needs and seeing how strategic and operating plans just can truly, as I said, shift some big levers and disrupt some narratives and move needles. And, you know, again, back to last year, a lot surfaced in our community. And for me, being from Minnesota, growing up with privilege, I will acknowledge that even as an adopted person of color, one often thinks about how they show up in the various communities that they work for and advocate with. So, you know, my career continues to be shaped by curiosity and through learning from other stories, as we alluded to earlier. And I've gained an understanding of what the systemic interaction is and this play that perpetuates some things that are fundamentally broken. So really, last year, you know, it was a culmination of the events that were happening in our world with my attempt to reconcile the needs that I just, second week into work, you know, bright and shiny, looked great. But once you got in there, boy, it was just not all that it could be, to be totally honest. And I just wasn't feeling fulfilled. And it was my piece too, to it, where, you know, I needed to reconcile, like, this was a different value set. And, last year for me was just really, it was just really a heavy lift.
2 weeks. That's pretty quick into a tenure to discover whatever it is you discovered.
Yeah. And it just didn't feel cool. You know, I waded through it, right? We all wade through stuff. We all shovel things. And, you know, in August of last year, my family and I spent some time up north with my wife's family. And it was during one night that our toddler was down. His two twin cousin toddlers were down, and his three other cousins were sleeping, that my mother-in-law came to me in the living room and looked at me, and she said, Noah,
they're not happy.
We've always known you to share about your work mm-hmm. and organization. But you've been quiet all year, like the last 7 months. Like what's new? What's happening? I didn't have an answer for them. I could not muster up an answer about the impact that we were making, the work that we were doing. You know, and I had nothing to say. And a social human who craves relationships, I couldn't even find a word, a development professional, I couldn't even find the word to answer a question.
Yeah, can't you just BS your way through that?
And it's, and on top of it, it's your mother-in-law, so you better be pleasing her.
Well, I mean, yeah, we all love Connie. But I just, it was that moment where I just knew that I was just, something had to change. Yeah. And I wasn't showing up as my genuine self. The work was cool, but it wasn't enough for me. And what I believe it was at the core was that I've always had the personal courage to take risks, but I didn't have the professional permission to be empowered to do so.
Got it.
And I think one needs both.
Yeah. So your wings were clipped immediately.
A little bit.
Yeah. That's frustrating because when you see needs and you know your own skill set and the possibilities to be fenced in, so to speak, and not able to really affect change. You know, Jason's book is all about that, right? Is you were promised X and such on your way in and you get there and it's like, well, we're going to be, you know, doing this. And it's very closed in, non-risk, non-big thinking. And it's like, yeah, I can do that. I can functionally do that job. But my heart is not soaring when I get up in the morning of like, wow, I get to really go in there and make a difference in other people's lives and right. be fulfilled.
How much of this tension, Noah, that you're describing, maybe tension isn't the right word, but we'll sit on it for this for the time. How much of this was the environment, the external environment, sort of the living in Minneapolis, being in the midst of 2020, being in the midst of COVID-19, and how much of this was the internal environment, meaning the organizational setting, the organizational leaders, the board? Because I don't think one of the things I'm looking at a lot lately in my own thinking, talking to my guest, reading, writing, is this idea of a more what some authors call an ecological rationality, a rationality that is sort of aware of the environment in which we're in and understanding that decisions cannot be made independent of an awareness of that environment. And so I think what a lot of us who perhaps, and I'm certain our listeners can sort of identify with some of your experiences, but if anything, if I'm sort of picking up on where this conversation is going to go, how do we differentiate and how do we better understand what was the external environment that a lot of organizations, if not all organizations, were going through? And how much of this was the internal environment that really was the creation of a couple of people, you know, a handful of people? Do you follow my question?
I do. That's a really great question. And I want to acknowledge that I think tension is actually a very appropriate word, just, you know, in concept sure. and in our conversation. And so I think it's a both and, I think part of it absolutely was the forces that happened. It was, you know, just from my own lens, you know, I started in mid-January. I didn't have more than probably 5 solid weeks of learning time from both staff and volunteers and youth that were being served, and then my portfolio, and then poof, pandemic hit. And then George Floyd was murdered and yeah. and it kept going. And so there were a lot of external forces.
Yes.
But the other piece to that was there was a lot of systems and structures that, you know, in my own lens, really needed to be adapted to what was happening. But the appetite in which to do so was just not always there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was actually going to, I'm glad you brought this up, because one of the things that I've taken is that when, you know, organizational health, and I think somebody said this on your podcast last week or the week before, so organizational health and organizational culture both matter
mm-hmm.
a lot.
Yeah.
And what I think and what I'm hearing from other peers in the industry is how the pandemic or how a crisis, a public crisis, really lifts up the positives or really exposes the challenging things that are happening in any organization or corporation. Like it is how you, I'm not going to use the P word. It is how you
adapt.
It is how you adapt. Thank you, Teresa. It's how you adapt and really transform and retool and realign with those forces that are hitting you or coming at you from a multitude of directions that, you know, that you can get some success from. So I think it's a both. I really do. I think it's
both. And we've seen organizations succeed wildly during this time by adapting and getting creative and learning, right? They're learning every day how to adapt to the external forces, and with learning with joy, by the way. They're discovering new ways of doing their business. And then we see those that almost gave up on day one to say, well, we can't do this because of external forces. And they're folding, they're closing, they're not able to carry out their mission, which is a tragedy. And very often that is because of a lack of inspirational leadership internally. Yeah. For someone to stand up and say, no, actually, I believe we can do this is the first step, and then get about doing it, even under these extremely challenging times. So it sounds like you've experienced both in a short period of time, maybe.
I have. And the other side of that, you know, regarding where I sit now in the organization space that I'm in, they did transition. I mean, food services and nutrition and food distribution and food insecurity was not part of their mission. But from March till the end of, essentially the end of this month, from last year to this year, it has been nearly 2 million pounds of fresh produce that would other, nearly 2 million that would have otherwise gone to, you know, organic farms, but that, you know, households and individuals experiencing all kinds of instability need. So that was a huge transition and an eye-opening one for the organization to be like, we can be the ones to think differently. It's okay that we can step up and we may not get it right the first time, but the fact that, you know, to your point, we're listening to the needs and we're responding to the needs and we can rally our internal troops, and it's going to be a little bit chunky and bumpy and rough, but in the end, we're going to come out better for it. And that for me was pretty inspiring to hear in terms of that organizational story. So it is out there.
I've been thinking, Noah, a lot about storytelling lately. And I think we in the fundraising world like to utilize the idea of story. We sort of like storytelling as an idea, but I think there's a darker side. I've been listening to some lectures from people who talk about sort of the darker side of storytelling and the realization and the awareness that sometimes the stories are not true. And I kind of wonder if, again, going back to that word tension, if part of the story that we have been told, those of us who have sort of landed in this work and we find ourselves in the midst of 2020, sort of dealing with the internal and external mess that sort of gets conjured up in any organizational setting, if that story starts to let us down, I think so many of us gravitate towards the nonprofit sector because we think it's some sort of a warm and fuzzy, feel-good sort of space, when in fact, we're the sector that's really supposed to show up when the world becomes scary as hell and when the shit has hit the fan. And we're supposed to be the ones ready to sort of navigate that stuff. And it's not about hugging kittens and, you know, kissing, you know, privileged kids or anything. I mean, and it seems like we've got a whole cohort of maybe our colleagues and peers maybe in this space. And this conversation may be the most enlightening for even like Teresa and I as you're sort of provoking our thinking. Noah, I don't want to be, as someone who's sort of speaking into the nonprofit movement and into the ideas of sort of these internal leaders, can perhaps we come out on the other side of this? And this gets back to what your mother-in-law was asking for. Was she asking for that warm and fuzzy feel good, what it means for Noah to work in the nonprofit sector? Or did she want to hear the down and dirty, what it means to be dealing with some really messy stuff at a really messy time in history? Because I think what's so compelling about the work that we do is the latter. And too many of us have perhaps landed in this space for the former.
Yeah. I really think that she wanted to hear the grit.
Okay.
And the grit from me is what moves donors.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you have, like, take a basic annualized stewardship process or a stewardship plan, right? It's always about what happens after the point of entry, what happens what are you doing, and how is the donor engaged along the continuum?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I feel like I'm the Veritas people right now, but what's been really encouraging to me and to hear from our sector, our local peers across the industry, specifically within the last 9 to 12 months, is how are you showing up to your donors in authentic ways? And by that, my example is when I have engaged a donor, for example, I'll call her Monica. Even though it was a short stint at my previous organization, Monica was one of those donors who had volunteered for decades and had seen everything, and then began matching her volunteer hours with a workplace gift. Then she matched her own gift with a monthly gift from her workplace, and then began giving, you know, annual major gifts. Yeah. And nobody had ever reached out in an effective, meaningful way to say, you know, those existential questions of, if resources were not limited, what do you want to see happen? Right. Those really big, like, idea questions. And once that was done, it became really easy to have just a shot list of, hey, this happened on the ground today. This is not pretty. This goes against all of our marketing materials. What do you think about that? That's a big piece of our mission, yes, Monica, that you're helping to support. And so how you bring them along with the grit is a piece of that magic process of that donor's relationship with you. And so I think it is about the grit. It is about the stuff that we shovel. And yes, it's, yeah, I mean, 80% of what's seen, I think, as you're alluding to, Jason, on the organization's surface is the bright, is the shiny.
Yeah.
As I think I may have said, A plus B equals C. But when the 20% of the time is the 80% of the time, that is when you need to fire up your communication efforts and say, your friends, this is what's happening on the ground. This is actually what's happening. You are helping make this possible, but how should we be thinking about this? And if you involve the donor, the supporter, or whoever is your stakeholder in that way, it's a different conversation. So I'm all for grit.
Like, I'm all for grit too, brother.
It changes
grit or bust.
Yeah, it changes them from an ATM to a partner.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and a really deep, like, collaborative partner, not just a partner with like an MOU or something. Like, it's a real, true collaborative
partner. Yeah, a thought partner.
Yeah. Thought leader, thought partner. Sure. Yeah. Sure.
But I don't think I think that's one of the things that plague our work. And Teresa's very familiar with some of our previous conversations, even as of this week. I had a conversation just a couple of weeks ago that will air just a couple episodes before this one about this notion of grit. I think we have tried so hard to design this profession so that it's warm and fuzzy and shiny and looks like marketing material, when in fact you can't build relationships with people. You can't meet the needs in these broken places. You're talking about, you prefaced this conversation with the idea, even before we hit the record button, we're talking about broken systems. And when we're talking about a broken system, it's going to get gritty. There's oil, it's messy. You're doing some troubleshooting.
It's gross.
It's gross. Yeah. It's probably going to be a little embarrassing. And if your partners, if your donor relationships don't in some way align with, I had a major donor once. He was routinely writing checks to the organization I was writing for example, to the tune of about $50,000, maybe a couple times a year. So this was a gentleman that was relatively invested in the organization. But what he said about the school, that, because this was a school that was offering a high quality private education in an inner city to low income kids. And he said what he admired about the organization that we both represented, in effect, was that we were doing high quality, very meaningful work in the hardest of places, you know, serving a population of kids that otherwise in any other context was not supposed to be getting that particular education. That's why he wrote that $50,000 check a couple of times a year. And I feel like if I'm reading between the lines, because I don't want to be telling my stories all day long here, if I'm reading between the lines, the narrative that sort of played out in your life And as you got to that moment in August with your mother-in-law, those stories, that's the stories your mother-in-law wanted to hear. That's the stories you were looking to sort of experience and do in your work. That's what I think lands us in a lot of this work, but that just wasn't happening.
Are you making a difference? What's the impact of your work? All of those questions. Yeah. She may not articulate it that way. I once asked my mother about her. She's very philanthropic. And I once said, "Hey, Mom, what are your philanthropic priorities?" And she giggled. She's very smart. She said, "I don't have philanthropic priorities." I said, "Well, I know you give to like 8 or 10 places." And she said, "Oh, yes. Well, now I give this much to them." And, you know, she articulated her philanthropic priorities. So sometimes we fly over their heads with our questions. But getting down to it, I would imagine, too, you seem like a nice guy. I just met you. But your mother-in-law cared about you and didn't see that light shining from the inside out.
Yeah, that's absolutely valid. And I took, from August, I just took a lot of time to just, from that question and from my inability to formulate some proliferation from the mouth, like something that would come out. I just spent a lot of time disconnecting and appreciating the seconds and the minutes of a day. Well, toddlers will do that too for parents, but I just truly began to take stock in what my professional priorities could be and what I could afford to just say like, that's a nice benefit. That's a nice feature benefit. But I don't need that right now in my life and what I could afford to let go and how I could just reboot for myself as our entire world is beginning to reboot slowly. And I had some realizations with all of this too. And I do want to circle back to the concept of disrupting the way we know things as fundraisers and disrupting the way that we view our work. But before that, many of my feelings and my realizations were shared by your guests actually over the past few weeks and really made real for me just to take stock and breathe for a minute. You know, it's one of those first thing is like, I need the trust. I need the authenticity. And I also do our conversation about gritty and disgustingness, like the humility piece to our work. Mm-hmm. But really what I've come to value is not metrics, is meaningful connections like that at the core, like that is what drives me. And I think somebody recently said that context matters and boy, context sure matters 2020 now and moving forward. And, you know, our work when done effectively is, as you all know, you know, takes investment. On the human capital side, when one actually brings a holistic view of, again, back to that intersectionality of our work. And I talked a little bit about how org health and org culture do matter, but you know, I should add a lot as those tensions happen. But simply, all of us need to be seen. All of us have a desire to be heard and valued. So, I mean, really fast forward to my current role, I'm empowered to create a team. There really hasn't been an advancement philanthropy team before. The organization has grown. So now there needs to, you know, they need to press the pause button and we need to put some infrastructure in place and some processes in place and more, but I get to co-create that, those systems with youth in our program alongside staff in our program. So those fundraising structures and systems are probably going to disrupt some of the norms that we all know, back to our point that we were talking about before, but some of the strategies and tactics that I think are going to drive some revenue, on the comms side, the audience engagement on the contributed or earned revenue side on that piece, they're rooted in this whole new way of, you know, some people call it, I think you probably both heard of community-centric fundraising or community-centric principles, but really just rooted in how those that value set and how that framework applies to the work that we're doing in a very non-prescriptive way. So that's my jam. Like that's my dream is to also bring donors along and of course meet and exceed revenue goals. Like if, when done right, like that's the easy stuff. The tough stuff is creating the model that's rooted in those values and truly like turning the Titanic without a rudder essentially or a paddle as sometimes it feels, but rooted in capacity, community collective community capacity, belonging is a huge piece of it. And really the fact that we don't, in our work, to your point earlier, Jason, like our work doesn't need to exist in nonprofit silos. Like all of us are, yes, the adage of, oh, we're going after the same donors. On paper, yes, but in practice, no. You know, there's a way that all of us can mutually exist and coexist happily and really be there to support one another. You know, back to what we were talking about those collective partners and those deep thought leaders, right? So
has that been happening in Minneapolis visibly? I would assume it would, but what have you experienced?
Visibly it has been. And I mean, just looking at like the food insecurity response or the response to that need, like we are with other organizations in community solving that need. So we have a lovely, amazing, incredible partnership, for example, with Second Harvest Heartland. But they're one of many, like that's the food side, but then there's the distribution side and what it takes for that. And, you know, all these other workforce development pieces that are coming into our program to make our in-school and out-of-school programs possible, but make our food distribution possible. So there's all these models, right, that are just like being shook up for the common goal. And I think we're just going to see a lot more, I would hope, a lot more collaboration and nonprofits coming alongside one another to then perhaps join forces and, you know, partner on the institutional funding side, bigger opportunities for grants and bigger opportunities for some, you know, waves of support.
And we've seen that locally here in our community foundations are connecting and saying, all right, we're all trying to solve the same basic problems. Let's communicate about how we're doing that and collaborate about how we're doing that as well, rather than work in the silos that you're commenting on.
Right.
It's so much more effective. Right. It's like, let's be open about what's going on. It's the old begin with the end in mind. What problem are we trying to solve for and engineer it backwards from there?
Right.
Rather than, hey, we've always been this organization that I'm struck by the fact that your organization adapted to the need versus saying, well, this, you know, our mission, we were founded on this. So this is what we do. Even though we were looking out our window and seeing this great need, that's not what we do. No, you said, why not? Why can't we help? I love it.
Because there's a piece of all of the why nots, that still exactly are in direct alignment with mission without even remotely creeping, right? So it's how you're thinking about the situation at hand. And I mean, I guess if I can do a quick, like, can I do a quick summary, like statement?
This is your show, brother. I get people on here.
Show?
I get people on here. We ask them questions. We provoke them to think, and then we get to we get to ponder it later. So
okay, well, fair enough. I was just, you know, in summation throughout all of this, like, call it like Noah's Quest 2020 is like, if it taught me anything, it was just the need for all of us as humans just to listen to ourselves. I mean, yes, and to others, but really listen to yourself. And when things don't feel right, like, try to unpack a little bit of that. And, you know, and finding whatever it is, like, mentally challenging or emotionally challenging or daunting that it would be, just to hold on to see yourself out the other end. You know, I think emotional intelligence shows up in a multitude of different ways. It doesn't have to be a formalized EQ, right, assessment, but I think somebody once told me that it's about 60 to 70% of success in work and in relationships. And I think it's probably even more so in the work that we do. So it's a process. I think somebody said on your show also, it's a process, not an endpoint.
Noah, do you think, okay, so we were all around pre-COVID and we were in the fundraising space. And one of the things that I definitely was paying attention to, this gets back to the storytelling and sort of the systems thinking about what it is that's perhaps broken. If you think about the conversations that were generally being had pre-COVID, you had a lot of us talking about sort of the exploitation of fundraising professionals, by donors who were sort of taking advantage of them in a variety of completely inappropriate ways. You also had a group of individuals that were talking a lot about mental health. You had fundraising professionals that were saying mental health needs to be something that we talk about. And you had a couple of other, you had a group of people, perhaps Vu and the others in the community-centric group, who were talking about sort of the injustices that are sort of embedded in philanthropy that go back, you know, centuries and stuff. And if you think about where we sit now, for the last year, a lot of that has had to go to the back burner in a lot of ways because we're all just trying to keep the lights on and the bills paid. And so we're just sort of back into sort of, you know, how do we get through the next payroll? But I wonder if we're going to if perhaps we can come because in both cases, Noah, I think the flawed, broken story is the same story. It's just playing out in a long-term and short-term context. And whether you feel like you were being, whether an individual who's listening to this feels like they were being exploited by the broken system pre-COVID, or whether you're feeling like your organization isn't really sort of measuring up in the midst of COVID, it's the same damn system. And if you think let's take this out of the context of fundraising and let's look at the young people that perhaps you're trying to serve and help and meet the needs of in a city like Minneapolis. The same stories being told to those children on those streets pre-COVID and in the midst of COVID, and it's the same bad, incorrect, deceptive story. Am I right? Paulo Freire, in educating children in Brazil, called it the narration sickness. It was that the people that are given the privilege of the platform or the podium or the front of the classroom have this incorrect story that's being told. We just had a guest. The conversation that'll broadcast, Noah, right before this conversation we're having with you, this gentleman was basically saying a lot of the, I mean, you guys could have been talking essentially two different sides of the same coin. Fundraising is meaningful work. It wants to be recognized and admired as meaningful work. People want to have meaningful relationships. Generally speaking, the donor on the other side of that relationship wants the same thing. There's got to be a different story to be told. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. And it is painful to think about how many, you know, little things, little times, like just the not the yucky side, but just like the really, ugh, here we go again, right, you know, side of things. Just like, oh, wait, I thought we already transitioned into a new way of thinking or a new way of talking about our work or a new way of co-creating a model. And I mean, I agree. Like, I think I talked to, in the last month, I've been networking and, you know, with my new transition and even at the executive director, you know, cause we all sit on boards too, right? So even at the other ED board governance level, like there is an appetite for something different. It's just, how do we come out and break through and make that platform accessible to those that might be too scared to have these.
Do we have the conversation? Noah, do we have the grit to get out? Okay. So let's say, for example, we get on the other side of the vaccines. Let's say we achieve some degree of normalcy, you know, 6 months from now, for example, do we have enough grit to know that when Walmart shares start ticking up really well and we start just applying for their food grants or something, that Walmart is in and of itself part of the exploiting broken system problem story to begin with? And that if your food bank is just taking $2,500 from Walmart, for example, you're not fixing anything. You're just playing through the same story.
I think so. And so I do think so, Jason. And I think, you know, I will give you an example quickly. When I was looking for my next step last year, there were a handful of organizations that had a, on the front end in terms of the applicant recruitment process.
Yeah.
There were a handful of organizations that were asking not about moves management, not about major gifts retention, not about any of the other stuff, not even about like, how would you interpret this narrative and package it to somebody? Like, flush. Right. No, not right. About that. Right. We're done with that. We need to be done with that. And the questions were, one of them had asked me if we accept this contribution from, you know, institution ABC.
Yes.
How would we think about the optics of what that means for those that were serving, if they were to see the name of that institution
right.
on a donor list,
right.
on a wall in a healthcare center or in a wing? And so, I mean, people are actively talking about that, especially in our community, yeah. again, with the equity lens. And I think there will be the time, hopefully within the next year, to yeah. where we start to see more people elevate conversations like these, because it has to happen.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in and of what the crux of it is, we're also, as you said, in a broken system.
Yeah. The other camp.
There's a way out.
The other camp that, so it's the mental health camp, the sort of the exploitation camp, the social injustice, sort of injustice in the philanthropic. And then it was the ethics camp. That was the other, this is all pre-cut. One of the things I picked up on, there's these four camps that were all sort of critiquing what was wrong. And I was like, don't you folks realize that you combine them all, they're all embedded in a broken system. And if you don't get your heads right. wrapped around this complex broken system that dates all the way back, perhaps to the Enlightenment or even before, when we're essentially out to, exploit other human beings, you're just fixing symptoms. You're not really fixing as I teach at the college, you're not addressing the root causes of all this. Right. So I'm never going to look at you, Teresa as a decent human being. I'm always going to look at her as an object, as a woman, or look at you as a person of color. And I'm gonna look at you differently. We have to look at this stuff differently. Stop taking these checks, perhaps from people who exploit this stuff. Oh man, Teresa, I could get so much trouble. You hear an honest story from a guy like Noah, and then you get me propped up, and I've had too much coffee this
morning. Oh no. No, I did. I had a conversation recently with a nonprofit leader who said, look, we've had a board member express views that are anti-racist, and we're just going to have to live without his money going forward. We just are. We can't, in our good conscience, take that and did I say anti-racist? Racist.
Racist. Yeah.
And he said, she said, we're just not going to do it. And I thought, well, wow, that's somebody's turned a corner. I didn't know her before, right. but good for you.
Yeah. And Teresa, you and I consult together. So I've been thinking about it through the client lens. Noah, this is sort of pulling the back of the curtain on my own sort of personal journey in the last 12 months too. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at this through my own personal relationships with my extended family. I'm looking at this as somebody who's trying to build up a consultancy, and I'm thinking, okay, whose mission statements is our team going to get behind in advance? And I don't want to necessarily suggest that I can only serve these far left sort of organizations that I might sort of favor, but I do want to be able to sort of say, maybe this isn't sort of these polarizing political things. Maybe this is just an appreciation, a decency of what human beings are. You know, Noah,
you would get in trouble, wouldn't you? look what we did collectively together.
Noah, it has been and by the way, Noah, we need somebody up in the Minneapolis area to join our team. So if you want to talk, let's talk. But Noah, it has been a pleasure to have you on the podcast this morning. We appreciate you framing the conversation for us. You got us stirred up. You certainly got me stirred up. We're very.
My work here is done.
Yes, sure. I'm glad it's a Friday afternoon. I have one more call, and then I can chill out. Noah, if somebody's interested in reaching out to you and wants to have a conversation, perhaps wants to reflect and continue to contemplate some of the things you've shared this morning, how would you suggest that they do that?
Sure. Multiple ways, right on my LinkedIn profile. LinkedIn is the easiest way to find me.
Okay. I will put that link in the show notes. Noah, it has certainly been a pleasure. You are always welcome back. Next time I or Teresa are in the Minneapolis area, we will certainly sit down for a cup of coffee or lunch or something. In the meantime, you're always welcome back here.
We long for those days. Thank you both again so much and for being in our corner and really for what your podcast does. It's awesome. So
lovely to meet you.
Likewise. Thank you both.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all-too-familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.